tonight on Arena. Julianne Ford and Ruth Tracy on their company's Oscar-nominated The Apprentice, and Steve Coogan in the stage version of Dr. Strangelove at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And if you want to watch proceedings, you can do so on rte.ie/arena. This is a big week for Irish film production house Tailored Films. They have the IFTAs on Friday, the BAFTAs on Sunday, and then on March the 2nd, they will be on at the Oscars. And this is all for nominations for their film The Apprentice, with Sebastian Stan up for Best Actor at the Oscars and Jeremy Strong nominated for Best Supporting Actor. The film, of course, has been in the crosshairs of the President of the United States ever since it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival last year. Delighted to be joined this evening on the programme by the founders of Tailored Films, Julianne Ford, who's with me here in studio, and Ruth Tracy, who is on location in West Cork, and we'll find out exactly what Ruth is doing in West Cork a little bit later on. But Julianne, nice to have you with us, Ruth, and we'll speak to you shortly. Julianne, the moment of the Oscar nominations for The Apprentice, can you describe it to me? How extraordinary a moment was that for you guys?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, I think we kind of went in with very little expectations because the film had a bit of a muted response from Hollywood in general, mainly due to the nature of the content, and especially in the US, you know, a country that prides itself on freedom of speech. We were very surprised to see how self-censoring, you know, a lot of the reception was there in terms of the uptake by distributors. But it was really, really great to then see the progression of, you know, Hollywood getting behind the film and really just getting those nominations for Best Lead Actor, Best Supporting Actor. And it was really exciting because we were invited by Screen Ireland, who financed the film, to go along with other films that were longlisted to see the shortlist announcement. And yeah, it was very exciting to be part of it. It was a really great moment for Irish film.
And Ruth, Julianne speaking there about the muted response from Hollywood. There certainly wasn't a muted response from, he wasn't President Trump at the time. He was a candidate. Was he in his candidacy? I think he was. He was not happy with the portrayal of his story, with Sebastian Stan playing the part of Donald Trump. This is the early days of Donald Trump before, when he was really starting out as a property developer, a rent collector initially, in fact.
Yeah, no, he certainly wasn't happy. And I mean, he released a statement to coincide with when it premiered at Cannes to, you know, essentially say it should be burnt in a dumpster fire. You know, I don't believe he's seen the film. I actually still honestly believe that there'd be a lot that he might like about the film, but I don't anticipate that he will watch it anytime soon. And as time went on, yeah, he released a few other statements. To be honest, they actually helped with our press campaign about the film. It kept kind of the interest in the film. But yeah, like we definitely, you know, he did try to, I suppose, scare off distributors, and he had success in doing that because we received a cease and desist letter after Cannes, and that, you know, essentially scared off potential distributors for US. So and it also unnerved some of our financiers in the film, which meant that we had to kind of replace them in order to release it.
And what about from your side then, Julianne? You know, cease and desist letter at any point, basically saying do not show this film or things will happen, I'm guessing, is the basic content. How much steel did the two of you have to gather up to say, we are moving forward with this, we're not going to stop, we're not going to cease, we're not going to desist?
Yeah, well, I mean, the film is an Irish, Canadian, Danish co-production. So it was us and the other producers that were involved. Yeah, we really had to kind of put our minds together to say, this is not going to stop us. I mean, I think everybody getting involved in the project, whether that was on the producer level, our director, the cast, all knew that it was going to have a level of controversy when it was coming out. So it wasn't entirely unexpected. And when the project originated, it wasn't really foreseen that Donald Trump would be running again for president.
Oh, so the candidacy hadn't been announced there. We didn't know at that point.
We didn't know. I mean, when the project was developed, yeah. like it was kind of over 5 or 6 years, you know, came to fruition. So no, it only clarified the closer the project came to production. And, you know, we did know at that point, you know, that it was going to, he would be in the running, but it was, it wasn't envisaged from the start.
Let us listen to a clip from the film, which features Sebastian Stan as Donald Trump. And this is a very young Donald Trump. This is Donald Trump who's met up with Roy Cohn, who basically became a huge mentor in the early days of his career, played by Jeremy Strong. Both of them, as I say, nominated for Oscars. And Donald Trump is being fitted for a suit at this point. And Roy Cohn is very aware of how you should look when you're wearing your clothes.
You know, I should have talked to Dad before announcing the Commodore.
He'll be convinced when he reads about it in the Times, okay?
Well,
you create your own reality.
It's not that easy.
Truth is a malleable thing.
But
are too tight, I think.
All right, well,
you have kind of a big ass. You know that? You gotta work on that.
We try something else.
My dad is tough, Roy. He's very tough.
Well, that's why you got to spread the news like it's already happening.
No, you can't push him around very easily.
Fine. Okay, fine. Then, let him push you around. Is that what you want?
No, I don't.
Look, very, very fine fabric, Brioni.
What is that, merino wool?
Looks expensive. How much is this?
$1,100.
Okay, that's...
Okay, we'll take it. And a matching shirt and tie.
I can't pay for
Forget
this.
It, okay? Forget it. Listen, here.
Nothing with this. Let's see.
I don't need your money. You'll pay me back with your friendship, okay? Quid pro quo. You'll be a friend to me. I'll be a friend to you. Okay, that's the pact, okay? If you look like $1 million, I look like $1 million.
That is the voice, the final voice there of Jeremy Strong as Roy Cohn, and before that Sebastian Stan as Donald Trump in the film The Apprentice. And the two producers of the film, Ruth Tracy and Julianne Ford, founders of Tailored Films, are with me this evening on the programme. You know, you were talking, I'll go to Ruth again in Cork on this one. You were talking about that cease, or Julianne speaking about the cease and desist order and how you said, no, we're going ahead with this. You expected some controversy. Ironically, when I watched the film, and even as I listened to that clip again, I thought some of the controversy around it, Ruth, would be about how sympathetic the portrayal of Donald Trump was. I mean, we get the issues there that he really was at sea in that early part of his career, and the relationship between himself and the character played by Maria Bakalova. I thought that was portrayed with some sympathy as well. Were you expecting that kind of backlash?
I mean, to some degree, yes, because, I mean, it is a very humanistic portrait of Donald Trump, you know. Mm. I mean, I think we recognise the caricature we see in the media, but what we really wanted to discover was the man behind that and how he became, you know, the monster or the man that we know today, I suppose. So, yeah, I mean, it absolutely, there's a lot of that you can empathise with in his early days in terms of just trying to make a name for himself, to prove his dad wrong, to, you know, get the girl of his dreams. There is a lot in it that I think is sympathetic to him. And I think also the fact that the film is kind of shrouded in controversy and people actually watch it and realise, actually, this is not that controversial. You know, to some extent, that speaks to the fact that, you know, people have kind of self-censored themselves and believe that something is very controversial when it actually isn't. And that's kind of strange for us as well.
I remember I spoke to both Jeremy Strong and Sebastian Stan around the time of the release of the movie Julianne. And I put it to Sebastian about, you know, this sympathetic portrayal. He said, well, what's the point in me just doing the pantomime villain? And quite right. And that relationship between himself and Maria Bakalova playing Ivana Trump is the character that she's playing here. Vital to the whole thing. What was the turning point when distributors said, maybe we should be giving this film a little bit more airtime, a little bit more screen time?
Well, I mean, the film always had a huge amount of support in terms of we managed to pre-sell most territories, you know, at the financing point of the film. And all the distributors outside of the US have always backed it hugely. Mm. It was more so it just had a bit of a muted response within the US until, I believe, Donald Trump was elected. And then I think there was a kind of a bit more of a sigh of relief. In fact, on the back of the nominations, it's getting a limited release now again in the United States. So, you know, I do think that people feel, especially because of the Oscar nominations, that it's like okay to like it, okay to go see it, okay to speak out about it as a film. Mm. Whereas before, yeah, there was a lot of self-censoring.
And the IFTA's on Friday, isn't it, coming? And then the BAFTA's on Sunday, Ruth. That's quite a lead up then to March the 2nd and the Oscars themselves. Have you a sense of, because obviously you have to go out there and sell this film to those who are voting in the various academies and to get them to vote for you. Have you any sense of what sort of reaction you're getting from Academy members?
I mean, generally very positive. I mean, particularly in terms of the BAFTAs and even in the Oscars, you know, people have kind of mentioned that Sebastian could be the dark horse in that particular category because, you know, he is very active about speaking about the film. You know, he goes to a lot of events. He's always so proud and so vocal about the importance of the film to him. And similarly with Jeremy, too. So they're really active, advocates for the film. And I think what we've just been, you know, really impressed with the support that we've received. We get so many emails from people that have just come across the film, realized how much, you know, they had heard about it. They'd kind of maybe avoided it during the election period because they were oversaturated with Trump. I'm not saying we're not oversaturated with Trump now, but I think people are kind of more open to having a look at it and kind of they realize that it's a really good film.
It has to be said too, you have a knack of picking people at the right moment in time. I mean, Jeremy Strong, who's nominated as Roy Cohn, he was just coming off the back of Succession, ironically up against his fellow star Kieran Culkin,
but always up against him.
Yeah, there you go. I'm sure they have their way of dealing with that between the two of them. But how is it just an instinct thing, Julianne? I'm also thinking about Bring Them Down, which I'll talk about at the moment. You got Barry Keoghan at a very pivotal moment in his career there too. How about getting those casts that you're getting? What is it?
Well, I think you always just have to believe in the cast. I mean, there's obviously going to be an element of luck, and there's also, you know, working with the right casting director to kind of like, come up with the right recipe. But like we've worked with, in fact, we had two Irish cast members that we were lucky enough to be able to send over to the film. It was mainly shot over in Toronto. So Owen Duffy and Valerie O'Connor were like playing opposite Sebastian San in different scenes. And, you know, say Owen Duffy, we would have worked with him as a lead actor on Let the Wrong One In a few years ago.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just lovely to be able to reprise relationships with actors like that. So, yeah, it's an element of luck, but it's also, you know, really believing in the people that you're casting, you know, and getting behind that.
Yeah, and I was saying, Ruth, that, you know, you managed to get Barry Keoghan at a very important moment. I mean, Barry Keoghan has been a rising star for some time. There's no question about that. But you got him just after The Banshees of Inisherin and before Saltburn, which, you know, is a very specific moment in his career. And he's part of this thing that we spoke with Chris Andrews about, this revenge, sheep farming revenge story, Bring Them Down. We spoke with the director last week on the programme. What do you put it under? Are you going to just say, we're lucky as well, like Julianne says?
No. I mean, I think, particularly with Bring Them Down, that was always a difficult film in terms of the subject matter. And, you know, even when it first kind of came to us and I read the synopsis for it, I was a little bit wary, you know, of the potential violence and just how dark it was going to be. Mm. But then as soon as I read the script, I was completely won over by how compelling it was. And I think it's the same thing essentially happened for Barry and for Chris Abbott. And it's why we had such high level cast for like a debut film with very low budget. It was on Bring Them Down, you know, so he was attracted to the material and I guess some of the themes in the script. So, yeah, but I still also realise there is an element of luck because, you know, I'm not sure would he do such a small Irish film again, you know, so we managed to get him in that moment. But he was attached for quite a while, you know, he didn't it was kind of, you know, all about timing again.
Yeah, again, there is an element of luck in that something else doesn't come up that pulls him away. Let's listen to a clip from Bring Them Down, which features Barry Keoghan. He's the neighbour of Christopher Abbott's character, Michael, whose rams have been have disappeared magically at some point along the way. And his Barry Keoghan's mother is played by Nora Jane Noon, and they're all together on the farm at this point, with Christopher Abbott's Michael trying to find out what has happened to the rams, and Mary Jean, or Nora Jane Noon and Barry Keoghan giving kind of answers.
Here, what do you know about these rams?
They were up on top. I just brought them down.
On your own?
Yeah.
That's hard work.
Well, for an old fella, it's hard work.
Hey.
Can I see them?
No, you can't.
Why?
So put them in the slurry.
Why would you put them in the pit?
For diseases and that.
Where's your pit?
No. No one's going near the pit.
Do they have any symptoms?
Yeah, swollen bellies and stuff.
I'll have a word with Gary when he comes back.
He didn't see them.
Your dad didn't look.
Sure know what they say. Where there's livestock, there's dead stock.
Watch your mouth, young man.
Just saying.
Michael. Sorry, Neil. I'll talk to him.
Okay.
You go easy.
Okay.
And that's Nora Jane Noon, Christopher Abbott and Barry Keoghan in a scene from Bring Them Down. And Ruth Tracy and Julianne Ford of Taylor Films, the producers of that film and indeed of the Oscar and BAFTA and IFTA nominated The Apprentice, are speaking with me this evening. You were saying, Julianne, as we were listening to that, that the BAFTA moment for Banshees of Inisherin and Barry Keoghan came up during the shoot of Bring Them Down.
That's right, yeah. We had released him for a day to kind of go over and attend the BAFTA Awards, and he came home with his BAFTA and, you know, brought it to the set, and people were getting selfies with it. And so, yeah, we really knew at that point, wow, he's, yeah, really on the up. Like, and, yeah, that was a great moment, you know.
I have to say, I don't know if you heard when I was speaking with Chris Andrews, Ruth, I was talking about Christopher Abbott and his Gaeilge. I mean,
oh, yeah. it's
kind of, do you know what? I wasn't going to play it, but let us play it again. This is him in a scene with his father, played by Colm Meaney, Christopher Abbott as Michael. Just listen to the quality of the Irish that he speaks here.
King Tom, eh?
Maul.
So Tom Maul.
Mála, I cared.
How are all them the Macaulay?
Tom, get the cool, fuck out you. No, who did you tell them?
They are most scared.
Gatis Christa, August Tolorik Tarin Yan.
Well, we may gaze to the Sun Radio. A Togatada.
That's Colm Meaney and Christopher Abbott there in a scene from Bring Them Down from Tailored Films. Ruth Tracy and Julianne Ford with me this evening. I said, Julianne, on the night I was going to rename him Christor Mockabbott. So good is the Irish in the midst of all of that. Did he come to the table read with that level of fluency and facility?
Yeah, basically. I mean, he had been preparing for a long time with Padder Cox, who, you know, we had paired him with as a vocal coach. But everyone was kind of sitting there at the table read, and he just opened his mouth and out came this like perfect Irish. And I think even Colm Meaney's face was dropping.
I mean, okay, Colm has his art. You can
really
hear Colm's Irish
the
is there. Yeah.
Yeah. But he was unbelievable. Like, and it's such a proud moment, you know, to have an Irish film with an American actor speaking Oscar Elga like that. And, you know, we're really proud, you know, commissioning the man supported the film. So did RTE. Screen Ireland, and it's just a really proud Irish moment to have that on an international stage.
I suppose in some ways it's very hard because we hear a lot more, Julianne, a lot more Irish language films and films with Irish language embedded within them. That seems to have come much more to the fore in recent times. Is it too much to link a lot of that into Colleen Kuhn and what it achieved in terms of that Oscar nomination a few years back?
I think it definitely paved the way. I mean, for us, it was just a little bit about the story. And I think that was kind of the main motivation, to bring the Irish language into it. But I think definitely it's in the ether. Yeah. Like, I think it's, with Kneecap and on Colleen Kuhn. And yeah, there's definitely a resurgence of Irish language celebration at the moment in films, which is fantastic.
And now, Ruth, what are you doing down in West Cork? Why aren't you up here in studio with me this evening? I accept that you're working, by the way.
I am. Yeah, no, absolutely. Today was the first day on our next production. So it's by the Irish writer director Damien McCarthy, who directed Caveat and Oddity, which was out last year, did very well and won a big award at South by Southwest and others. So it's called Hokum, and it's essentially a horror film set in kind of an old remote Irish hotel where a writer comes to spread his parents' ashes, and he's unaware that the place is supposed to be haunted by a witch. So it's very classic suspenseful horror, which is Damien's absolute forte, and it's starring Adam Scott from Severance. So again, probably very fortuitous and lucky timing with casting there again, but we're absolutely thrilled to have him over.
Yeah, I see Peter Coonan is in the cast as well.
Yeah,
so
Peter Coonan, yeah, David Wilmot, amazing kind of up-and-coming Irish talent, Florence Ardesh, Will O'Connell and others as well.
And I'll get it mixed up as to which, but you can correct me on it, Ruth. One of you was very interested in sound when you first met up, I think, in IADT, and the other one was very interested, maybe possibly still interested, in director of photography work as well. Yeah. So which was which, Ruth?
Yeah, so I'm the kind of the sound fan. I specialised as a sound designer, and Julianne was a cinematographer. So sometimes we kind of say she's the eye and I'm the ear, because we do really kind of gravitate still to those areas. Like on The Apprentice, I was very involved in the sound design and kind of the music aspect, and Julianne was managing all of the VFX. So it's great to kind of be still able to, flex the skills that we learned at college still.
And what pulled the both of you then, Julianne, towards the production side of things and, the administrative, organisational, financial aspects that particular job entails?
Well, we decided to set up a company together. And, we were kind of making smaller projects where we were both really rolling up our sleeves and kind of, acting in those roles, but also had to produce. And then we always wanted to be in entertainment. And as the company grew and we had the opportunity to kind of move into that space, producing entertainment, that's when, it was when you're producing, you basically have the opportunity to create your own projects. You're not, if you're crewing, you're waiting on somebody else to approach you.
Tell so you what I think, to do, yeah.
I think we both like the idea of just getting projects off the ground, kind of working with people and talent that we like. And it's invaluable to have that practical background, though, to really understand what it's like to be on set and the practicalities of the filmmaking. And then, we definitely learned about the financing and the...
Yeah, and I guess the DOP and the sound design skills are not going to disappear overnight, I'm sure.
Well, they'll probably get rusty, but they won't disappear.
They won't disappear. Lovely to have spoken with both of you this evening, and thanks for taking time, Ruth, to come off the first day of shoot to be with us, and to you, Julianne. That's Ruth Tracy in Cork, and Julianne Ford with me in studio in Dublin. Absolute best of luck to all three upcoming ceremonies, and I hope there'll be awards galore, not just this year, but in films to come from Tailored Films. Thank you both for being with me this evening. And Bring Them Down, current release from Tailored Films, is in cinemas now. Steve Coogan is in Dublin at the moment, starring in Doctor Strangelove, the stage version of Stanley Kubrick's iconic film. The stage version opened last week at the Borgosh Energy Theatre. The film came out in 1964, much-loved satire on the very real threat of nuclear war at the time, in which an American general decides off on his own bat to send B-52 bombers to drop a nuclear weapon on the Soviet Union. All that stands between the world and annihilation are a British colonel stationed at the General's airbase and the US president and a team of his advisors and military commanders in Washington. none of whom would inspire confidence. Peter Sellers famously played three key roles in the film. Steve Coogan takes on these roles and one more in this stage production adapted by Armando Iannucci and director Sean Foley. Polly Shields has been to see Dr. Strangelove for us. She's with me in studio right now. You really have to think of the film, Paula, I think, in terms of the time of its release, the 1960s. I mean, I don't know who came up with the mutually assured destruction, which the acronym is MAD. Were they aware of that or not? I don't know. But it was a very specific moment in history when fear was rife about nuclear destruction.
That's right. I mean, the film is 60 years old now. Mm. And in a way, I wish it was less relevant now than it actually still is. But at the same time, there are phrases like the Cold War. And I think, well, some people will remember what that means and others won't. The film came out 2 years after a thing called the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was when the US, led by JFK, and the USSR, the Soviet Union, led by Khrushchev, nearly went to war in Cuba. So the whole nuclear threat was very alive in the air. You know, it's a very, very serious, frightening, scary time. And Kubrick launches this film, which sends up the American generals, the American politicians, their advisors, probably not really just the Americans either, but it's really savage. And he took a real risk with it. Like, it doesn't pull its punches.
So I suppose the entire point of Dr. Strangelove comes down to a couple of lines in the opening scene. General Ripper, John Hopkins plays General Ripper in this stage version, and it sets the whole, it's a comedy of errors, satirical comedy of errors. It sets the whole thing in train.
Yes, he is on an airbase. It's a kind of remote airbase, and he believes there's an imminent threat. So he has these B-52 bombers already in the air on a training exercise, except they're already fully equipped with nuclear, with hydrogen bombs. And
the thought of them up there in the air with hydrogen bombs is already frightening.
34 of them. And so he drops his command, and he's telling the British Colonel Mandrake, who is the first of the Steve Coogan roles, what he's doing. And he says, he reminds him that Georges Clemenceau, who was the French Prime Minister during World War One, that's how far we're going back, said, "War is too important to be left to the generals." And he says 50 years ago, he may have been right. But today, it's too important to be left to the politicians either. And the brilliant thing about the film and the stage production is that both points are proved right in the course of the story.
And does it feel all too contemporary? All of those points still being made?
Yes, because, you know, we're living in such a weird time and things feel, you know, there's a lot of tumult around and there's a lot of, you know, in the 1990s, this would not have had the same resonance that it does at the minute.
That's right now. Now, Peter Sellers in the film Tour de Force playing three characters. Remind us of the three characters he plays, which Steve Coogan does on stage, plus one more.
So the first one is that British RAF colonel has been sent over in secondment to this Air Force general who's gone rogue, and he's a kind of bumbling idiot, except he's cute enough to realise that the general, this is not a good idea, and he's trying to stop him. Then the second role is the US president, who's called President Muffley. They have Kubrick had a lot of fun. He's one of the writers of the original script. They have a lot of fun with names. The Russian premier is called Kiss Off and the ambassador is called Back Off. I mean, it's not subtle stuff, but it is funny. So he plays the US president's kind of a bland. Peter Sellers played him as a very still figure. And he's surrounded by all these advisors. And again, you don't have much confidence in any of them. The third character is the title role, Dr. Strangelove. And of course, he is the Germanic sounding, shall we say, scientific advisor, director of weapons research.
Again, not subtle stuff.
No, not at all. He's got a kind of white Andy Warhol wig in the production, and he's in a wheelchair, and he's prone to calling the president Mein Führer. And then the fourth role, which Sellers apparently was meant to do in the film and then got injured and couldn't do, is the role of Major Kong, who is the chief pilot in charge of the B-52 bomber we're following, who gets across the line, and who's this kind of mad, seems to think he's in a rodeo rather than, you know, not taking things seriously.
Now,
either.
Three, and in this case, well, four on stage, but three characters in a film, a lot easier to manage you have time. You could do one scene in one character, another scene as the next character. You can get changed, do all of that in between. In a stage production, it has to run nicely right through the big arc of the evening. How have they translated the film to the stage?
Well, I think one of the fun things about going to the stage version is the audience, you're partly watching it to see how they're going to do all of this. So Sean Foley.
So do you need familiarity, do you think, with the
film? I think
film?
It helps.
Yeah.
I think it helps, and the film is a pleasure anyway, so why not? But I think it stands on its own as well. You know,
talking about Sean Foley, sorry.
Yeah, he's directing. And so they've stayed quite faithful to the script to the original in some ways. And you're looking at a big circular table for the war room. And then Ripper's office is kind of a wreck as he gets more and more chaotic. And the B-52 bombers, they come in at the end in the second half. The cute thing about the staging is they use video projection, a lot of it, and they use it very well. So the first time we see Dr. Strangelove, for example, he's on screen and the US president, it's Steve Coogan talking to himself. So there's a few playful moments around that where they really use that 3D setup of the stage, and it's an in-joke with the audience. You know, we're watching to see what they do. The set is amazing. It looks like money went into it. Hildegard Beckler is the set designer. And it's a thing of beauty, and a lot of the transitions work very well. There's a slight problem with the staging in the sense that in the film, you're locked into three claustrophobic spaces. Mm. So really quickly, you're brought into the cockpit with these pilots. So you've got that sense of 30 minutes, 20 minutes. And this is till they drop the bomb in Russia. And you've got that sense of real urgency and something real at stake. And I assume for staging reasons, I don't know why, but the first time we see the cockpit is at in the second half of this production, and it leaves the first half feeling a little flat in places, and it feels a little theoretical.
Mm. So is that down to the nature of the production, or down because it's Iannucci, Armando Iannucci, great collaborator with Steve Coogan, who has written the script, and let's face it, scripts of the past have been huge successes for them.
I think Iannucci, like Coogan, is the other star of this production, really. And he is the director and the writer of The Death of Stalin on film and The Thick of It and all of these things. So expectations are high. I think partly he doesn't do enough that's new with the script. I mean, in a way, for fans of the film, you'll see all those lines like the US president saying at one point, "You can't fight in here. It's the war room." And all those moments really kick in very well. And there's a few contemporary lines where the US president says at one point, "I'm having such a bad day. I'm sorry I won this election." And of course, somebody next to him says, "The other guy thinks you didn't." And we all know who that's a reference to. Right. But beyond that, I think he doesn't play with it enough. And I think there were moments in the script and longers, you know, where it just feels a bit flat.
And you'd put it down to script rather than direction.
Well, I think it is more script than direction, but I do think then it's the lack of having the B-52 in the action sooner. The first half is just the war room and General Ripper's office, and that's a lot to lay on two locations.
Well, and the sound of a B-52 in a theatre can create a B-52 if you let your imagination, do that. Steve Coogan in the four roles, how does he manage? Because is this his stage debut, which sounds kind of extraordinary, but obviously we know him from screen.
I think so. And he's brilliant as the British colonel who's bumbling, but scrabbling to find the three-letter code that's going to recall the bombs and save the day. So you have to, he has to tread a fine line there because you have to believe he's an idiot, frankly. But you also have to believe in him enough that he might swing it for everybody. And there's a lot of great scenes between him and John Hopkins as Ripper. Great, great fun. He's superb as Dr. Strangelove. And there's so many reminders of what a good physical actor he is. He's in a wheelchair as Dr. Strangelove. The legs are twisted to one side and they look atrophied. Now, he hasn't done anything apart from move his body. But it's a real pleasure to watch him. The US president, I think that's a more ordinary role for him. It's fine, but there's a lot of hand waving and arm waving that should have been tightened up at this stage because this did open last autumn in the UK. And it did remind me that he's newer to the stage than he would be, say, in film or television.
But has he got, you know, those incredible kind of swift changes that sometimes happen in this type of production where they're making a point, I'm guessing, out of him playing the four characters. And sometimes there are little stage tricks that can help that.
Yeah. And also, when it comes to Major Kong, for example, in the cockpit, he's having a ball as that kind of madcap cowboy type in charge of the pilot with no consequences, you know, no idea of the reality of what he's up to up there.
Overall, does it actually work? Before I ask you that, are there other performances? You've mentioned John Hopkins a couple of times. Are there other performances that you pick out apart from Steve Coogan?
General Turgidson, the warmongering madcap general, who's played by George C. Scott in the film, who is brilliant in that role as well, is played by Giles Torreira here, and he is incredible. But like all the cast were amazing. And there is a sense of the battle scenes and the sound design. Like there's, I suppose for me it was about 60%, which is a terrible thing to do to bring numbers into it. But like, you know, there's a great sound design to it. There are great battle scenes where the president gets a local army to try and contact General Ripper, who then just starts shooting everybody. And you believe those. There's a lot of tension to that. I just think it falls down in one or two places.
Overall, would you say go, or do you need to be a fan of the film? Is it going to interest people who are fans of the film more than anything else?
I think it's one for fans of Steve Coogan.
Ah, because and there are lots of those.
It's a rare opportunity to see him live on stage, up close and personal.
All right, that's Paula Shields speaking to us about Dr. Strangelove, which is at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre until 22nd of February. 40 years ago, Wim Wenders' celebrated road movie Paris, Texas went on release in Irish cinemas. It had had its world premiere the previous year at the 1984 Cannes Film Festival, where it won the Palme d'Or. And while it is considered a masterpiece now, back then the decision was met with some consternation. Paris, Texas tells the story of an aimless drifter, Travis Henderson, played by Harry Dean Stanton, who embarks on a quest to reconnect with his estranged son and his wife, Jane, played by Nastasia Stinsky. To look back at Paris, Texas, 40 years on, Stephen Benedict is with me in studio. The soundtrack, slide guitar score composed by Ry Cooder, was also a defining aspect of the film and played a pivotal role in creating the mood. Of Ry Cooder there, as heard in Paris, Texas. I think, in fact, that is one of the opening scenes of the film. Stephen Benedict with me in studio to celebrate Paris, Texas at 40. Before we get into the making of the film itself, we're in road movie territory here. Yeah. Who's following who? Where are they travelling to? What is the story?
Okay, the movie begins in the desert with this very mysterious character walking through the desert, a very disfigured character. Turns out to be Travis Henderson, played by Harry Dean Stanton. He has been rediscovered after 4 years of having disappeared and abandoned his family, his wife and his child. And then his brother reunites with him. His brother is Walt, played by Dean Stockwell. They bring him back to Los Angeles, where he's reunited with his estranged son, Hunter. And then he embarks on a search for his estranged wife. He doesn't know where she's gone, but they go off in search of her. So it's a road movie twice over, because he goes and he's lost at the beginning without roads. His brother goes in search of him, finds him, brings him home to Los Angeles, which is full of roads, and they go off into the desert on another road. So it's a road movie.
And Sam Shepard, you mean, it has Sam Shepard written all over it, doesn't it, really? He wrote the script.
Yeah, he did. I mean, it started out with the title without a plot. It was called Motel Chronicles, and he had a series of monologues, and he had been approached by Wim Wenders, this great German director.
why on earth was this great German director doing an American road movie?
Well, you got to understand that Wim Wenders has always been fascinated with American culture. He was born in Dusseldorf just at the very end of the war, and he grew up in a Germany, in West Germany, at a time when American Air Force and military bases were very, very common in West Germany. And he came of age having absorbed and fascinated by American music, American literature, and American cinema. And then amongst his first films, Kings of the Road, Alice in the Cities, and the Wrong Move, they're all road movies. Mm. And it's in Kings of the Road that he has one of his characters utter the immortal line, "The Yankees have colonized our subconscious." And he was talking about himself. So he then, those films gave him a great international platform. He went to the United States, and in the late 70s, he met Sam Shepard just before Sam Shepard won the Pulitzer Prize for his play Buried Child. And they hit it off and they said, let's make a movie together. But it wasn't until the early 80s, 1982, that they met again, and they set out to write what was then called Motel Chronicles.
Let's have a listen to Wim Wenders talking about the nature of the collaboration with Sam Shepard and pinning Sam Shepard down, which I guess was not an easy task.
Sam was at the time the greatest theatre author in America. He wrote only a handful of scripts, but all of them were damn good. And Sam was an authority on the American West. And he was one of the great writers of dialogue. And even today, lots of young actors, when they find a text to present themselves, they choose Sam Shepard. Sam and I had the great plan that he would come with us and travel with us when we're making the film. And so we said, we only write half, and then you're going to be with us, and you'll know the truth of the story, you know the actors, and we find the ending, the real ending. That was a nice plan, but Sam fell hopelessly in love with Jessica Lange before we started shooting, and decided instead of traveling with the German to the West, he was going with the love of his life to the North of America.
Wim Wenders, very diplomatic there in his explanation of how the collaboration worked and didn't work between himself and Sam Shepard on the film Paris, Texas. Stephen Benedict with me in studio this evening talking about the film 40 years on. He wanted, Wim Wenders wanted
Sam Shepard
himself to play Travis initially, didn't he?
Yeah, and as you said there, he went off to make a movie and fall in love with Jessica Lange. So no disrespect to Harry Dean Stanton. Harry Dean Stanton comes in to replace Sam Shepard in that role. And I think if there is a weakness in the film, although Harry Dean Stanton gives a fine performance, I think he was miscast. He is far too old for the role. And you're looking at him and then you see him talking to Nastassja Kinski and you say, they are not a couple. They were never a couple. If Sam Shepard had been cast in the role, it would have worked better. I'm not saying it doesn't work, but I think if there's a weakness in the film, it's that. But clearly there are great strengths in the film. And one of them is the way Sam Shepard and Wim Wenders reshaped the American myth of the West. It takes in several myths, Greek myths, for example, Orpheus and Eurydice, because Travis goes in search into the underworld to try to rescue Jane. You've got Ulysses and Penelope, because we now see what Penelope was doing in Ulysses' absence, where she has to fend off all these seedy suitors. And then you've got the Searchers, which is the movie John Ford Searchers, starring John, when he appears out of the desert at the beginning of the film and he goes off in search of his niece. And when he brings her back, he doesn't stay. He has to leave.
Let's have a listen to a clip, and it's interesting that you bring up that age difference in the casting of Harry Dean Stanton and Natasha Kinski, because he tells her a story at one point along the way, and it kind of feels like, here's the explanation of why I was cast in this role instead of Sam Shepard.
Yeah.
I knew these people.
What people?
These two people. They were in love with each other. The girl was very young, about 17 or 18, I guess. And the guy was quite a bit older. And he was kind of raggedy and wild. And she was very beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
And together they turned everything into a kind of an adventure. And she liked that. Just an ordinary trip down to the grocery store was full of adventure. And they were always laughing at stupid things. He liked to make her laugh. And they didn't much care for anything else, because all they wanted to do was be with each other. They were always together.
Sounds like they were very happy.
Yes, they were. They were real happy.
That's Harry Dean Stanton and Natasha Kinski there in a scene from Paris, Texas. Stephen Benedict looking back at 40 years of the iconic Wim Wenders and Sam Shepard film. You get a sense of it there that stage dialogue is very different from film dialogue. Lots of gaps, lots of spaces within all of that. So the dialogue isn't carrying this film, that is for sure.
No.
The visual language, what
absolutely.
Kind of do
a
we
lot
have
of that,
there?
A lot of
did
that.
They reinvent that in the way they reinvented the myth, the American
Well,
myth?
No, I agree with you. That's a really good point, because the director of photography, Robbie Muller, what he did brilliantly was he juxtaposed the really, really strong neon signs of the motels and the roadside diners with the dusty colours of the desert. And then he goes for the horizontal of the desert with the verticality of the cityscape. So he's constantly juxtaposing those. And the great thing about it is, no matter what you're looking at, it's always evoking something else, some other place, at some other time. And that begins with a title. It's not Paris, France, it's Paris, Texas.
Yeah.
And I think what Wenders and Shepard did was that they reshaped the American myth and they gave it an asphalt spine. They said, this is the heartland. The vein of America is the road, as opposed to the dusty trails of the cowboys.
And we were crediting Ray Cooter, of course, with the creation of a lot of atmosphere with the music itself. Yeah. But that in itself was a recreation of earlier music. Let's have a listen to this. This is a mashup of Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground by Blind Willie Johnson. And you'll hear that. It's a very early recording.
Yeah.
And it makes its way into Ray Cooter's version of the same song from the movie. Wonderful slide guitar there of Ray Cooter picking out from the Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground performance of Blind Willie Johnson from the film Paris, Texas. I remember watching the film and going straight out to buy the soundtrack. It is such an important part of the movie, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I actually got to hear the soundtrack a lot more many, many times before I got to see the movie, because I was far too young to get into the cinema. I was given an 18 certificate. So I bought the soundtrack and I spent literally 2 years listening to it.
Listening to the film.
And it painted pictures. The music painted pictures before I saw the film. It's quite fantastic.
Why then? I mean, it's considered a masterpiece now, or certainly a very important film. Yeah. Why did it cause such consternation at Cannes in 1984?
Well, there was a number of frontrunners. There was a movie called Another Country, which is about Guy Burgess, the notorious Cambridge graduate who ended up spent decades spying on Britain for the Soviet Union. And there was a quite brilliant French film called A Sunday in the Country, which is set just before World War One. And then there was the Irish movie, Cal.
Were we in with a good chance with Cal? There was a lot of buzz about it at the time, of course.
Yeah, and that was about an IRA recruit who falls in love with the NORUC's widowed widow of an NORUC officer.
But John Lynch as
that's right, and Helen Mirren as the widow. And the thing was that the chairman of the jury that year at Cannes was Dirk Bogarde, the British actor. And he recounted this episode later in his memoir, which he published a few years afterwards, called Backcloth. And he says that the then director of the Cannes Film Festival, Pierre Viaud, issued him with an instruction. He said, you were to choose a film which will please a family audience, not one which will appeal to, quote, a few students and a handful of faux intellectuals. Family entertainment for all the world markets. So Bogart took that, told the jury, they went off, they said, which film ticks all the boxes? Paris, Texas ticks all the boxes. And VO says, you think that Paris, Texas is family entertainment?
You'd have to understand his question. It has to be said. But well worth watching and listening to.
Oh, the soundtrack is absolutely superb.
All right, that's Stephen Benedict bringing us through Paris, Texas, 40 years old this year. Well, 40 years in Irish cinemas, released, of course, first in 1984, our first scene at Cannes. That is our lot for this Monday evening here on Arena. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Research this evening was by Leah Murphy. James Feeney was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.